once you go down that road of group responsibility,
yeah, you achieve fairness.
You end up in a really bad place.
You remediate the sins of the past.
You end up with genocide and all kinds of really nasty stuff. And
but genocide is only nasty if it turns the model of oppressor and oppressed on its head. It's a form of social justice. Welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. Today I'm speaking to Jens Heike, author of the book Out of the Melting Pot, Into the Fire. We have a wonderful conversation in which I attempt to steel man arguments, and those responses are quite interesting. I hope you enjoy the show. Jens Heike, welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. Thanks for coming and joining me in London.
Hi, Peter. I'm a longtime listener and a first-time caller, so I'm happy to be here.
Excellent, excellent. So you wrote Out of the Melting Pot, Into the Fire, and it was a book about, well, you tell us in a few sentences what it's about.
So the book really talks about what the dangers are of dividing people into different groups, treating people as members of groups instead of as individuals, and how that contrasts with the melting pot approach of integrating people into a unified whole, having people share a sense of super tribe or superordinate identity.
Okay, and so what is the danger?
Well, the most extreme danger is in countries we've seen like Yugoslavia, Sri Lanka, Rwanda, is mass killings, genocide, violent conflict. But there's a lot of bad things that happen short of that. Just in terms of a loss of social cohesion and all the negative stuff that goes along with that, higher levels of corruption, lack of civic participation, and so on.
And those things are caused by what? Failure to integrate into the society?
A lack of a sense that we're all in it together. Loss of any kind of sense of social cohesion, of unity, and what we can see is that's really essential to societies. Robert Putnam did a lot of work in the United States on that, showing that the most ethnically divided communities, people in those communities do what he called hunkering down. They pull back. They don't contribute, and they don't participate in the society. So, a society can work really well if everybody follows the rules, but yeah, there has to be something more than that for it to work well.
Okay, so in your book, you talk about the melting pot. And I remember when I was in graduate school, a lot of people were talking about the mixed salad as a metaphor. So tell us about the melting pot.
The melting pot, the term was originally used all, at the time of the American Revolution, actually, by a guy by the name of Hector de Crèvecoeur, who talked about different groups coming to the United States, mostly Europeans, integrating and forming sort of a unified sense of being American. And it was really immortalized in a play in the early 1900s by a guy by the name of Israel Zangwill. It's literally called the melting pot. Mm-hmm. And it's the sense that wherever you come from, you can join in the sense of being American. And I think it's often given a bad rap that it really means like the sort of one-way assimilation, that everybody has to just shed any notion of their former heritage and become this Anglo-American. And that's not how Israel Zangwill envisioned it.
So what's the mixed salad?
So the mixed salad is more the idea that you come together and you maintain a fairly distinct identity. There a lot of different metaphors have been used.
Right.
Others have used mosaic. Yasha Monk talks about it. He uses a public park metaphor. I would say the mixed salad one's kind of the next one up in terms from the melting pot in terms of maintaining separate identities.
So in your opinion, and you were in Sri Lanka, you've been all around the world, former Yugoslavia, et cetera. So what exactly have you studied? Have you studied how different people integrate?
Yeah, exactly. How governments have treated having different groups. What sort of integration policies have they followed? Or have they followed policies of treating people as members of separate groups? The most extreme version of that is, say, programs like affirmative action. So I've studied how those different approaches have worked, not only around the world, but through history.
Are there any emerging themes from your research or things that you found, like, I was laboring under this, I'll tell you, by a Kurdish economist who lives in Sweden, that the number one factor that determines whether or not an immigrant will successfully integrate into society is not what I would have thought, like, intense religiosity would have made them less likely to succeed. That's not true. It's that they have a marketable skill and they can make money. Is that correct?
I wouldn't agree with that 100%.
Uh-huh.
I think there needs to be a willingness to meld into the culture of whatever country you're
so it's a to. It's a disposition. It's an attitude
yeah.
towards something. Okay, so this is a little controversial, but and I realize that I may be asking you to make a generalization, and if you're not comfortable with that, that's fine. Are certain attitudes about integration, are they different from people's, like the people of Vietnam or Sri Lanka or the former Yugoslavia? Are they different or are those attitudes uniform? Is it a country by country thing? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a linguistic thing? Is it a historical thing? What is it? Is it a religious thing?
It varies from country to country. The United States has had for 200 years this sort of melting pot ideal. Other countries like Yugoslavia, they had it for a little while, and then they abandoned it. And they decided to go down the path of distinguishing people starkly by group, and they instituted separate educational tracks for different groups. And in the case, they also had quotas for different groups. And my argument is that that's when Yugoslavia really started going downhill.
Okay, so do certain groups of people integrate better into host societies than other groups of people?
I think, naturally people whose cultures are more closely aligned are going to integrate more easily. People who are of European descent are going to integrate a little more easily into a European country. It's going to be a little different if you come from the Far East or the Middle East. It's a little more challenging.
Which groups integrate well and which groups do not? And just to be clear, we have not had a conversation about this before.
No.
Okay, this is the first time we've met, the first time I'm asking. Okay.
Yeah, this, I don't think I can say in a blanket fashion.
Okay.
Because, there are examples of very diverse people integrating all over the place. Most people don't know this. World War I, the U.S. Army had 15,000 soldiers of Arab descent. That's World War I already, right? So a lot of the stereotypes you might have don't necessarily apply.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, are there some groups that integrate better and some groups that not? And if there are, what are the defining characteristics of those groups? Is it they can be economically independent? Is it educational? Is it some kind of subcategory? They're engineers. I got that from the suicide bomber thing. Is it religious? Is it from the what is it?
Yeah, I think you take all of those together, and it's just a matter of having cultures that are closely aligned. So if you take Canada, for example, they actually have a higher percentage of immigrants than we do. We're at about 15% foreign born, which, by the way, is really close to matching the high that was reached in the early 1900s. Canada's around 20%. Yet if you look at Canada's immigrant population, the single largest group are people of Indian descent who are highly educated and almost
right.
all English speakers. They tend to integrate very well.
That's what I was thinking of. So what do they have that allows them to successfully integrate?
Well, they have the English language. In some sense, people from India are still sort of in the Anglosphere. So they have that very high levels of education. Compared to normal Canadians, they have roughly twice as many PhDs per capita as native-born Canadians. So highly educated, English-speaking, all of that helps.
Okay. Does immigration policy affect or have any relationship to how well people integrate into the society?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, again, I would use Canada as an example. And it's funny, my left-leaning friends say, you know, why can't we be more like Canada or more like the European countries? Well, Canada is, you know, they have a point system that's pretty darn right. demanding about right. about who they admit. And, you know, like I said, they're admitting a lot of Indian PhDs. And, you know, you go to Quebec, and it's even more constraining there. If you want to get a work visa, we're talking about having a level 7 French fluency, which I think conversational is 4, right?
Oh, wow.
I couldn't do a level 7. No way.
I couldn't even do a level 0.
Okay. So,
well, maybe I know one phrase in French that I won't use on you, but anyway.
And you know, to give you another example, this I think just recently passed there. They will only deliver social services in French in Quebec right now, and no exception for refugees. So they've taken the approach, like, you become a French speaker in short order, or you're out of here, basically.
All right. So I want to ask you a question. So I had Matt Goodwin and Eric Kaufman on the show, and we talked about the processing in Rwanda and what's going on with that for UK immigrants who come here. I'm so curious as to your opinion about that. So could you explain a little bit?
I believe it's still being debated. I forgot if it's in the House of Lords yet. I think it's gotten kicked around a little bit. But, you know, the idea was that kind of like the United States, you have a lot of people who claim, you know, refugee status who want to come directly to the nicest place. And, you know, Britain says, well, no, you know, why don't we send you to Rwanda first and, you know, assess your status while you're there. That's about as much as I know of the program, but they're offering to pay the Rwandan government quite a bit to take those people. In a lot of cases, you know, some of these people are from practically neighboring countries. They're from other African countries, and they're complaining bitterly because they came from neighboring countries close to Rwanda. They said, you know, we made it to England, you know, how can you send us back here?
So I want to go back to this idea. You've traveled around the world. Tell us why you traveled around the world and tell us what you did there and what you learned.
Yeah, so I particularly focused on countries that have diverse populations and have changed their approaches or had unique approaches into how they integrated their diverse groups. So it's obviously taken me to a lot of places with a lot of conflict, places like the former Yugoslavia, places like Rwanda, you know. And so that my research has been about how, you know, how do they handle this and how has it worked out for them? Most people don't know, but, you know, there have been many countries around the world that have affirmative action programs, a lot of them for longer than the United States.
And define affirmative action.
Affirmative action is a program to either make up for past grievances between groups or to eliminate current disparities by favoring one group or another for education or employment.
What countries have instituted affirmative action, and how has that worked out?
So the first one, the Soviet Union, in the 1920s, most people don't know about this. There's a wonderful book written about it, Terry Martin, called The Affirmative Action Empire. And they decided that it would be useful to encourage different group identities. They literally, they stamped in people's passports what their ethnic identity was. And then they instituted a quota system based on ethnic identity. And it ended up that these identities sort of took off, and there was all sorts of division and antagonism between among them. And it ultimately ended up in 9 different ethnic cleansing episodes. People have forgotten that in history. So that's your first instance of affirmative action in the 20th century, 1920s. And, you know,
where else culturally has it not worked, and where has it worked?
I would say it hasn't worked anywhere. And, you know, one of the ways you can say that is because it's never ended anywhere it's been instituted. You go around the world, and affirmative action has always been proposed as a short-term solution, you know, 10 or 20 years, and then we'll have equity, then we'll eliminate the disparity. Yet everywhere you look, whether it's Malaysia or India started their affirmative action program 70 years ago. It was supposed to be a temporary thing. It's still going on.
Okay, so the claim is that these haven't worked, and not only in the United States, you've gone around the world. What are some of the best remedies to pass racial discrimination if affirmative action has not worked?
The best remedy I've seen is to assiduously eliminate any sense of group difference. Focus on the idea that there aren't any groups. We're all just one. So this is what Rwanda did after their genocide.
Yeah.
And you know, they could have gone down the route of saying, "Yeah, we're going to make up with past discrimination
with
present discrimination, just like Ibram X. Kendi wants, right?"
Correct.
They could have done that. Instead, they said, "No more groups. There's no more Hutus. There are no more Rwandans." And they've managed to do very well since then. You know, this is a country that had. It was dead last in the world. They had great economic growth since then. You go there, it is a beautiful place, and people get along. By no means perfect, but given that they had a genocide 25 years ago, it actually worked pretty well. Botswana is another country that did that. They wrote into their constitution that you cannot distinguish people by race, tribe, or anything like that. And it's the nicest place in Africa right now.
So if the claim is that affirmative action has failed, what's the response to, well, if we didn't have affirmative action, then we wouldn't see Group X in any positions of power or authority?
I think, historically in the countries that have integrated, whether it's Rwanda or Botswana or for that matter, the United States, people have made it to positions of power. They do eventually.
Small numbers, though, right? Small numbers. There has been no proportional representation.
Are you talking about the United States?
Well, I'm thinking about the U.S. and African American populations. I'm thinking about, depending on how it's defined and biracial, et cetera, between 13% and 17% of the population. And yet we don't see those numbers mirrored throughout the institutions.
We don't yet. That will come. If we look at incomes for different immigrant groups in the United States, there are, I think, 16, 17 groups that make more on average than white Americans of European descent. And, some of those are fairly recent immigrants. In fact, if you look at African immigrants, people from Ghana, Nigeria, and so on average, they make slightly more than white Americans of European descent.
Yeah. What do you think accounts for that?
For those particular groups doing well? I think that group as a whole are fairly educated. They're fairly ambitious. They also haven't been subject to 50 years of being told that they're victims and that they have no agency, over their fate. And, that's what we have in the United States right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. So just a few more questions that I find this conversation about the United States fascinating. So as many people are impatient in the U.S., they want immediate proportional representation. How long should they be willing to wait? Like 5 years, 10 years? And that's the... We could talk about equity, but that's the kind of prescription for affirmative action.
Yes, and equalization, if allowed to proceed on its own, it takes a while. I think we fall into the trap of comparing that to perfection. Let's compare it to the alternatives, right? And the alternative is to divide people by group and treat them as group members instead of as individuals. And that has its own consequences, which I believe are far worse than waiting for that equalization to occur.
All right. So define identity politics.
Yeah. Identity politics, I would say, is a system by which a person's group membership is considered ahead of their individual traits, that there's a relentless focus on groups rather than on individuals.
And there are many, many people in the United States who are big fans of identity politics. They think this is a fantastic idea. So I have two questions for you. One, steel man it, and two, what's wrong with it?
The commander said, "Don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today," which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
So the argument for it is to achieve that equity. Right, that you want.
We have to define that now.
Well, equity is the sense that people come out with proportional outcomes, like you were talking about before. That they're the percentage of people in any given profession should match their percentage in the general population, or the percentage of people in management should match that proportion in the general population. So that's your sense of equity, and one of the ways you can get to that is you can basically legislate it and say, this is how it's going to be. We're going to have, 13% of doctors are going to be black, and 20% will be Hispanic, and so on. That has a lot of negative consequences.
Yeah, we did a Reed and I went to, with Travis, we went to UCLA, and we were doing spectrum street epistemology, and we asked people to stand on the mats, and there was a black student there who said that he was he upset? He was something negative. I don't know what actually the adjective would be to describe his feelings, but that there were not more people who look like him. I mean, what is the response to that, if not affirmative action?
Let me give you an interesting counter story.
Sure.
There was, I told you a little bit about Botswana, a country that's been colorblind since 1960. You call them up on, which I've done many times on the phone, their statistics bureau, ask them how many black people, how many white people in the country, and they can't tell you because they haven't kept those statistics for over 60 years. So there was a Botswana embassy employee working in D.C., and he moved into a neighborhood, and this was, I think this was in USA Today, Washington Post, this quote. And somebody asked him, they said, how does it feel to be the only black person in your neighborhood? And he did a double take. He said, what do you mean? I've never noticed it. To him, it was incomprehensible. He didn't even think about that.
Isn't there a danger at not taking aggregated statistics for example, the grooming gangs here in the UK, Rotterdam, et cetera, or the rape gangs in Sweden? Wouldn't there be a danger at not taking that statistical data because then you can't intervene in the target populations?
I think, as with affirmative action, you're using race or group as a proxy. And, focus on the phenomenon itself, whether that's economic underperformance or if it's, rape gangs, whatever the phenomenon is, good or bad, that you want to focus on that itself, because race and all these other categories are only proxies for that, and they're not necessarily good ones. And using them is divisive. And that's what my research has shown is continually focusing on that. The cost is so high.
Okay, tell me about that, because I'm struggling to understand this. So is the idea that if we truly lived in a colorblind society, which, by the way, that's a microaggression, but let's just say, if we truly lived in a colorblind society, then we could investigate, for example, crimes of rape, underage rape, and not have to worry about the identity of the rapists. And the idea is that law enforcement would be more effective at discharging its mission. Is that the idea?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
You got to focus on the phenomenon itself, and it's the same thing. On the other side, the affirmative action side, that race has become a less and less good proxy for academic performance and for who needs a boost and who doesn't. You can give affirmative action to black students. Well, you're going to be helping Sasha and Malia Obama, and lots of other people who are really well off. So don't do that. Focus on people who are disadvantaged.
If I could wave a wand and everybody would be immediately colorblind, that would certainly seem to solve a lot of problems.
Absolutely.
Obviously. One of the things that we hear over and over is, and it was just, a football guy, or I don't know anything about football, but someone said, you know, I do see race and I want to see race. And there's something about seeing race that enables me to solve issues of discrimination. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, wouldn't the very idea of him seeing race cause the problems that he's claiming that he wants to solve in the first place? Because he's engaged in the task for which, if he weren't engaged in the task, he wouldn't be contributing to the problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, that's exactly it. And it's really important because this is kind of the Robin DiAngelo thesis, that if you say you're colorblind and you don't see race, that doesn't mean you acknowledge the existence of racism, or it means that you deny racism exists. And it's not the same. You can aspire to colorblindness and at the same time oppose racism. To me, it's actually the same thing.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it seems rather obvious to me. Yeah. You know,
she in particular has, and Ibram X. Kendi also, have created a sort of a straw man there, that all these people who say they want to be colorblind, that they ignore our past racism. Quite the contrary. We see past racism and we want to eliminate it.
And we want to eliminate it through colorblindness.
Exactly.
So the idea then, so you're opposed to equity-based measures.
Absolutely.
And when you've gone around the world and you've done the research, have you seen any attempts to remediate, quote, systemic discrimination or past injustices using an equity as like a fulcrum to try to lift up people whose ancestors were formerly marginalized?
I think, you know, Sri Lanka is probably the best example of that. That, you know, you had a country that had hundreds of years of groups getting along. Right, the British administrators, when it got independence, they said, you know, this is an amazing country. It's going to outperform Singapore. It's going to be like the best place in the world.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. And it was all kind of fortuitous. You know, you have two groups there, the Tamils and the Sinhalese.
Yeah.
Tamils are a little better educated. You know, so they at the time, they constitute a greater proportion of doctors and engineers. So some politician came in and said, we're going to achieve equity. We're going to fix this disparity.
Yeah.
And he did that. It was an electoral ploy, right? And he was actually very cynical. And, you know, when he was talking off mic about it, about that he was doing it for political reasons. And, you know, what happened? They started a program of affirmative action, and boom, civil war. Genocide. 50 years of on again.
Because while one group felt resentful?
Yeah, so both groups, just by instituting that distinction, he sowed discord between the two groups. And what was really weird, and this is something you see over and over again in affirmative action programs, is that the group that benefited from it, actually, they became the guys who attacked the other group. Because one of the things, you know, when you get that sort of benefit, you start to get protective about it. And one of the ways you maintain it is by demonizing the other group. You say, oh, you know, those bad Tamils, they're cheating on tests. And they literally said that. They're cheating on the standardized tests. So we have to have even more affirmative action. And so a lot of it was actually Sinhalese attacking Tamils and not the other way around.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So here's a country that, you know, was supposed to do better than Singapore 60 years ago, and it, you know, it's basically a hellhole now. They've got 1/8 of the per capita income of Singapore. So that's one place where it was absolutely disastrous.
So I want to go to Sri Lanka in a prison, and Reed and Travis don't want to go, and you calling it a hellhole is not actually making my case for me. But that's okay. Do you think that the U.S. is at a risk of a civil war if we continue going the way we're going? A lot of people talk about national divorce. Some people are even talking about civil war. Do you think if we continue instituting these equity-based policies, is that, from what you've seen analogously, has that drawn the kind of ire and resentment that you'd worry about in the U.S.?
It's drawn a lot. And we've also seen a lot of the other things, the bad things that happen that aren't specifically, you know, ethnic violence. So, you know, let's just take, for example, a poll, which you've probably seen, that showed back in 2001, actually, that 70% of black people in this country thought race relations were either good or very good,
yeah.
Right?
I don't remember the poll, but I remember that.
In 20 years, that went down to 33%. We went from 70% thinking race relations were good or very good down to 33% in 20 years. So what happened during that 20 years? Well, we had a black president twice. The other thing that happened, though, is we had a proliferation of identity politics, and it spurred intergroup antagonism. To give you another one, 2012, they did a poll on how many black people felt they were held back by discrimination, and that was roughly 30%, just a little under 30%. Today, it's 70%, right? Wow. So it's flipped on its head. And one of the things my research has shown is that when you develop those sort of group, that group antagonism, sense of group separateness, it has a really corrosive effect on society, and it comes out in economic performance. It comes out in levels of corruption. All that stuff that Robert Putnam showed, that, you know, that comes to the front.
In your book, you give specific claims. You argue against those claims. What I would like to do is to try to defend those claims. And then I want you to tell me if there's anything wrong with my reasoning. So let's talk about Ibram X. Kendi's famous claim, the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. So to be clear, and I'm sure this is going to be memed out a million times, I don't believe this, but I'm going to try to steel man it and to make an argument for that. So there are certain groups, and I'll just stick to the United States context just to make it easier, we're both Americans. There are certain groups in the United States that have been subject to historical discrimination. These groups haven't had the opportunity to accumulate wealth. They've gone to bad schools. They've suffered a myriad of social injustices. Any kind of equality of opportunity is insufficient because those individuals, those children, et cetera, have not had an opportunity. For example, redlining in the United States, or being excluded from certain neighborhoods, or being excluded but being literally hunted down by the police. So we need some kind of an equity-based system to discriminate against, frankly, white people, males, and heterosexuals. That's the only way we can attempt to equal the playing field.
Yeah, so first off, if that was the answer, you really have to explain how it is that we've had this for 50 years and that alleged goal still hasn't been achieved. So, you know, why are we doing something?
What's the this in that sentence?
Affirmative action.
Okay.
You know, so we've been doing affirmative action since the early 70s.
It's been the answer to that is easy. It's not been extreme enough.
So we need even more of it. So
correct.
We do, like India, have 70 plus years of it. You know, at what point, I would ask, at what point will we step back and say this isn't the way to go? Are we going to continue it 100 years? You know, 200?
Well, we would continue it until we had proportional representation of African Americans in positions of authority.
Yeah.
From the Supreme Court all the way down.
And, you know, so one of the consequences of that, there are multiple consequences. One is that you encourage people to see things from a group perspective, which historically has been a terrible thing because it pits people against each other, creates antagonism. And, you know, we've seen that in polls in the United States that show decline in perception of race relations. That's been one thing. The other thing...
Before we go to the other thing, so what is the argument against... So if the claim is that pits people against each other, if the response to that claim is some people should be pitted against each other because they have perpetuated a system which is grossly unfair, and the goal isn't to pit people against each other, but that's a natural consequence of doing the right thing, which is equity.
Yeah, so... you know, again, keeping in mind that these programs have been in place for many decades, what you're doing is you're pitting people who weren't even born when these programs began against each other. People like my kids who, you know, affirmative action has been around my entire lifetime. It's been around my children's entire lifetimes. It's the only reality they've known. So pitting them against others. I'm not sure how that makes sense.
Well, are your children white?
Yes.
Well, has it occurred to you that they deserve to be?
That they just deserve to be discriminated?
Yeah.
You could go with that line, and I think what you end up with is a large percentage of your population being really disaffected, and that's not good for a society, for a large contingent of people to feel like they're systematically discriminated.
Okay, so then how do we weigh out it's not good for people versus the achievement of equity? So, why shouldn't the oppressed group be pitted against the oppressor group?
Because it weakens your entire society. You destroy social cohesion. And, that's what my book shows, is that, where that's been done in other parts of the world, you've ended up with, not just ethnic conflict, but genocide, and society is working really poorly. So that's the first part. And the other part is that if you start putting people into slots that their qualifications don't merit, you have what they call a mismatch problem. And, we've seen that across our educational system, particularly in law schools and medical schools. What happens is you take a very highly qualified minority candidate and you put them in a place that's a step above where they should be. So somebody, a student, for example, who'd do very well at Purdue, they might be a star at Purdue. Well, you send them to MIT instead, where they fail.
But that, wait a second, does that assumes that the purpose of the institution is something other than to promote diversity? And the institutions are incredibly clear that diversity is their mission, diversity is our strength. So you're only looking at it as a problem because you're buying into certain meritocratic ideals.
Well, I think those students who fail from these schools, whether or not they buy into the system or not, it's failing them. A higher percentage of black students fail out of medical school and law school.
But that's a reason for equity-based grading. That's not... what's the...
And then you end up with a system... full of unqualified people in various positions.
So how do you adjudicate those? You end up with a system that has unqualified people, but yet you end up with a system that's more diverse. Why is having unqualified people, I understand why one could consider that a problem, but isn't that trumped by the fact that you now have more diversity?
Yeah, if you want a system where people avoid having a black doctor or a black airline pilot because they feel like they don't have to meet the same criteria.
But we already have airline pilots who are hired on the basis of race, and that doesn't seem to bother
anybody. I think we're gradually getting to that, where people are starting to express those sort of feelings, and that's really dangerous because you can't get away from that then. You can't... If I were a black person, I wouldn't like to always have a question mark next to my qualifications, where people wonder, did I really earn that or did I get that because I'm black? That's really destructive.
Even if in aggregate that increased the total number of people in those positions, and doesn't that assume that the people who are black who hold those positions didn't get them through merit?
I think when you advertise a system that's systematically benefiting certain groups, that's inescapable. Of course, people are going to see it that way. Those questions came up with Claudine Gay, for example. She didn't get there because of her merits, which is probably true.
Well, many people like Mark Lamont Hill and others said that it's mediocre white people attacking an accomplished black woman.
If you look at her actual qualifications, I've never heard of a major university president who hasn't written a book, has 11 academic papers, I think, and half of them or more with plagiarism in them.
But doesn't that assume? So, what do you think the assumptions implicit in that are? Because it's pretty obvious to me. The assumptions implicit in that are there's something more important about the meritocracy than about proportional representation.
Oh yeah, it's about putting the best people, in those important jobs.
Whether that notion itself is a racist hangover.
Perhaps it is, but
okay. So if it is, then what would be wrong? What would be wrong with institutions valuing diversity instead? Diversity is our strength, and it is more important than meritocracy.
That we, you know, that we end up with a society that's corrupted from the top to bottom, where there's no sense of having the best people in the positions where they belong, and also, and this is another thing that my research showed in particular in Sri Lanka. This has happened in Malaysia. When you start this business of distinguishing people by group and not actually, you know, evaluating individuals on their merits, you set a paradigm for corruption through the whole society.
But it's only corrupt if you presuppose the idea of the meritocracy. If the point is not meritocratic, if the point is proportional representation, it's not corrupt at all.
If your desire is to have diversity, for example, what you have is you have you know, white people cheating on the system too because they've decided that the whole thing is corrupt. So that corruption pervades all of it.
And what have you found in your research that argues against some of those points?
As I said, in both Malaysia and Sri Lanka, it really came out that before Sri Lanka started their affirmative action program, they were the least corrupt country in Asia. And what happened once they started down that path of saying we're gonna aim for equity, that notion of equity got expanded. So we're gonna benefit one major group over the other, and now we'll benefit one geographical region over another.
How do you know that's causal with corruption and the collapse of the society?
Because that didn't happen in other places that didn't have the affirmative action. You can get accounts from these people too and see the progression. It didn't start until after the affirmative action started there. Right.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that a core assumption in your argument and also running through your book, is that countries that have valued colorblindness and merit decrease their disparities?
Ultimately, they do.
Do you have evidence for that?
It gets a little tough to document. A country like Botswana, for example, does not keep the data anymore. So, you can't necessarily tell.
But that is the assumption of the argument, right?
Well, what you can look at, yes, it is. And if you look at the overall performance of those countries, they've done very well. Rwanda, after they eliminated group distinctions, that their economy took off.
So then how would you know that if you value colorblindness and merit, your disparities will be decreased? How would one know that? Like, what data, what evidence could there be to show that?
You could show that the bottom of those societies has lifted up, right? So not just the average, but the lower tiers have also been elevated over time, which has certainly been the case in Botswana, where they've been colorblind. It's certainly been the case in Rwanda, where they instituted colorblindness.
But the disparities would remain, though.
And again, in those two countries, it's hard to statistically evaluate that because the categories aren't kept anymore. You don't necessarily have proof of that. What we do know is what happens when you go the other way. When you keep those equity programs, everybody ends up worse off. And this is something
pause. What do you mean by worse off?
They worse off economically, worse off in terms of intra-ethnic violence, all those other social indicators. One of the things I found, and I literally asked people, I had to be pretty blunt about this in some of the quote areas where I asked this, in, say, former Yugoslavia. I asked members of both groups, or in some cases, three or four different groups, did you end up better off or worse off by instituting these programs, by instituting these distinctions? And 2-1, every single one of them, whether they were the beneficiaries of affirmative action or if they were on the other side, they all say the same thing.
Really?
No. They said, we are much worse off.
In all your cultural studies,
yes,
you've gone to these places and that's the...
So let me give you an example, where you can evaluate it a little bit better. So Singapore and Malaysia, very close together. They both have Malay and Chinese populations. Malaysia has had affirmative action for 50 plus years. You could ask any ethnic Malay living in Malaysia, would you rather be in Malaysia where you get affirmative action, or would you rather live in Singapore with the ethnic Malays in Singapore where there's no affirmative action? And they'll tell you they're a lot better off in Singapore. The statistics show they're better off in Singapore.
Well, there could be other variables.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, causality, you and I both know, causality is one of the most difficult things in statistics to establish.
Okay, so my question is, I guess, would the world be a better place if some economic outcomes were sacrificed in order to reduce disparities?
I would say no. And okay. Again, I, you know, using those examples, that everywhere where it's tried, you end up with really bad results. That reaching for the equity ends up in pitting groups against each other. It ends up in inferior economic performance. It rarely achieves the desired results.
And how many countries did you go to for this, to study this?
I for the research in my book, 40 different countries.
That's indeed impressive.
So it's, yeah. It's,
and just to be clear, you've been on the ground in these places.
Yes.
So you're not just like Googling stuff. Like,
no.
You've been there. Okay, so the next claim is every disparity in outcome is caused by systemic discrimination. So I don't believe that, but I'm going to argue for that. So this is, of course, Ibram X. Kendi's primary claim. So I'm going to do the best that I can to steel man an extraordinarily difficult claim to steel man. Let's see if I can do it.
No, you did a good job with the other ones.
So, okay. Every disparity in outcome is caused by systemic discrimination. We know for a fact that there are disparities among different racial groups. We know this. So I'll just give you one quick example. We know that there's a disparity on SATs, this scholastic aptitude test, between minority groups. We know that there's a ranking of those: Ashkenazi Jews, cold climate Asians, whites, Hispanics, and blacks. I would argue to you that there's a system of discrimination in place that causes African Americans to do more poorly, and that's the legacy of racism. We know, for example, SAT scores are correlated with zip code, and people in wealthier zip codes tend to do better, and they tend to be white in general. So that's not a one-to-one ratio, but we also know, for example, that there are very few Navy SEALs who are black. And the reason there are very few Navy SEALs are black, obviously I'm not a Navy SEAL, but my understanding is that they don't have access to swimming pools, which tend to be in more wealthy neighborhoods. And so it's a type of invisible system that's in place that causes disparities. So there can be a system that Helen Pluckers talks about this, in place in which nobody is actively a racist, but the whole system is constructed to keep people down, certainly to keep people whose ancestors did not have an opportunity to accrue wealth. So every disparity in outcome is caused by systemic discrimination would seem to be a true claim.
The fact that most piano makers in the United States are of German descent is that the result of discrimination?
Or that would be a system, yes. It would be a system in place.
Or that, you know, a plurality of building managers in Chicago area are of Croatian descent. Is that also the result of
that would be a system? It would be a system because there are only three possibilities. Genetics, which is not possible that people whose ancestors have been subject to different evolutionary pressures would be different cognitively or physically, so that's not possible. We know it can't be culture because all cultures are the same or equal, so therefore it has to be systems.
So how do we explain the fact that immigrants from countries like Ghana and Kenya and Nigeria make on average as much or more than people of white European descent? Sorry about that. Didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No. They're the children of wealthy immigrant parents.
Yeah, except if they're first generation, which most of them are. There's this list, I think I had it in a Substack article, of 17 different groups on average that make more than the average person of white European descent. Most of them are brown skinned, right?
Indian, cold climate Asians.
Lebanese, for example, Ghanaians. You go all around Africa, Middle East, they all do better than on average than white people. And there is undoubtedly, demonstrably, a cultural element to economic success.
All right.
That's documentable.
All right. So I'm just going to keep running through these claims.
Sure.
The melting pot is oppressive to minority groups. I think that the melting pot is oppressive to minority groups because it teaches them to integrate into society as opposed to retain their own linguistic heritage, their own, for example, my grandparents were Armenian, and there was really a stigma. They spoke to Armenian to each other and to my dad, but there was a stigma about them speaking Armenian in public. So the melting pot causes a kind of cultural genocide among immigrant groups who attempt to assimilate.
Yeah, that's a bad rap that's been given to the melting pot ideal over the years. The melting pot ideal doesn't say you have to give up memories of your past culture at all. In fact, Israel Zangwill, who wrote the play The Melting Pot, was really specific about that. He said it's about a two-way process. Groups give to America and parts of their culture, and they get incorporated, not lost. People of Irish descent to this day, that's still celebrated. People of Mexican descent, none of that's forgotten. So it's not about giving up culture. Melting pot is about forming a super tribe that encompasses all of us and takes in contributions from everybody.
So the claims that I just make, you're saying, are demonstrably false. They're not incompatible with the melting pot idea.
Absolutely not. So, I give you a good example. I spent most of my childhood in southern Idaho, which is a really heavily Basque area. I grew up learning Basque dances and doing Basque weight carrying competitions. I can still do Basque dances, actually. And I'm not of Basque descent. So that was shared. And all of these people of Basque descent consider themselves to be American, and they were part of that melting pot process. And
that's just because they've been brainwashed.
Yeah, it's a good brainwashing. They seem happy. They're happy to be American, and they're happy to remember their Basque descent.
So what do you make of the claim that the American super tribe is not compatible with certain cultures? So, for example, they'll be somehow damaged if they're forced to integrate to the society.
I think, historically, you'd have a hard time finding such an example. There's so many different groups that have come to the United States and become part of that super tribe.
Well, which is more important, looking at facts, data, and evidence in history, or my feelings?
I'd go with the facts, data, and evidence. That's my choice.
Okay.
That's my final answer.
Okay. okay. I want to do a couple more claims. No one is illegal. So we call, for example, people who are in the United States illegal immigrants when they're in the United States, and perhaps they don't have the proper paperwork or passports, or they've been fleeing from some kind of totalitarian oppression, usually by white people. So those people we call an illegal, and that is a word that is demeaning to those people. And we should stop using that word illegal. They are citizens of the world.
By coming into the United States the way they did, they broke the law. So you'd maintain then that we should not call lawbreakers. Or a person who commits a felon should not be called a felon.
Well, felonies are only felonies because of the law. If you took away the law, there'd be no felonies. The same like criminality. There's no intrinsic criminality. The law makes criminals.
Yeah, and then we'd have a Hobbesian scenario.
Nasty, brutish, and short.
Yes.
So isn't contained in your argument the idea that countries have a right to national sovereignty?
Absolutely.
See, I don't believe that. I believe the United States should have completely open borders. Nobody is illegal. Anybody fleeing any kind of horrific persecution
should be able to come.
Should be able to come. And the idea of illegal is demeaning to those people. We have plenty of space, and there's plenty of work available.
Yeah, you'd have to identify one country to me that's followed that practice and survived.
Just because they haven't followed the practice, it doesn't mean it's not a good practice.
So to give you an idea of the numbers, we're approaching 15% foreign-born in the United States right now, which is really obviously a record in absolute terms. Percentage terms, we're matching the numbers in the early 1900s. Now, I went to a conference in Sweden last year where they've hit 20%. And it's 20% that's, let's just say, less culturally compatible. Didn't speak the language at all.
Yeah, but that,
so on.
That just means the host country has to bend to be...
Yeah, so Sweden is pretty much the rape capital of the world right now. I think it's number two in the world, which it wasn't even close 20 years ago.
They stopped gathering statistics, is my understanding.
And yeah, you actually can't tell the group anymore. You can only tell whether or not they were an immigrant. And the immigrant children aren't even counted. So talking to them after that big wave in 2014, they're scared to death there because they feel like their society is breaking down. And, you know, there are no-go zones.
Okay, well, let me pause you and say that my argument is an equity-based argument that white Europeans raped many, many people in Africa, and this is a form of equity. And the Swedes did let them in, right? So this is a kind of a form of reparations.
So are any of those Swedes or any of the people that raped folks in Africa, are they living in Sweden right now?
They certainly could be, but the Swedes and other Western Europeans committed horrific atrocities. So I don't see what the problem
is. Their descendants should be held responsible for those atrocities.
Well, that's equity.
Yeah, that, Jews should be held responsible for killing Christ.
Well, it's another form of equity.
I think once you go down that road of group responsibility,
yeah, you achieve fairness.
You end up in a really bad place.
You remediate the sins of the past.
You end up with genocide and all kinds of really nasty stuff. But
genocide is only nasty if it turns the model of oppressor and oppressed on its head. It's a form of social justice.
Yeah, and you know what's so interesting about that is amazingly there are countries that actually have gone down that path, and you know those are the countries I talk about in my book, and it's precisely what they did, right? And that's how you ended up.
Like what countries?
Oh well, like Rwanda. You had a million people killed in 100 days with machetes, right? That's like 50 million Americans.
Well, that's the only days. A problem is because there are both parties were black.
And the Tutsis were deemed the oppressors, right? They raped and dominated the Hutus, therefore payback. And that's what you ended up with. You ended up with, you know, a million people killed in 100 days. You know, that's what happened in Sri Lanka. It's what happened in Yugoslavia. It's what happened in the Soviet Union. Every time you go down that path of holding a group responsible for what their ancestors did, you end up in a really bad place. You end up with genocide. You end up with you know, phenomenally bad economic performance.
So you would argue that it's bad no matter who is genocided. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Well, I find that argument to be fallacious.
Yeah. Well, if you believe one genocide merits another,
I do.
I'm not sure we can argue much from that point.
An eye for an eye.
Because your grandfather did something bad to my grandfather. I'm entitled to kill you. That's. Although that's precisely what's being called for in some places.
All right. So I'm going to make another argument.
I'm
going to try to make an argument for identity politics. In a democracy, people can vote for anyone they want to vote for.
Yeah.
most people, most of the time, will vote for people they think will advocate for their interests. If people see someone who looks like them, for example, a woman, a black lesbian, a trans person in a wheelchair, and I'm a trans person in a wheelchair, those people are more likely to represent my interests than a white heterosexual male. So identity politics would be a good thing then, because we can vote for people who share our identity characteristics, something with identity level salience, and we can vote for them to advocate our own interests, and that's perfectly compatible with democratic values and principles.
It's compatible in that, you know, people can vote for whoever they want, but when you have a society that starts dividing along those lines, it typically ends up badly. Distinguishing people by group never tends to work out well. And, you know, we know from so many social...
It worked out well for Hitler.
Yeah, it didn't work out so well for 6 million Jews or for, you know, all the other groups that were distinguished against. And you know, that's precisely the problem, is once one group, and you know, this comes from anthropology, sociological studies, that once one group starts to you know, group up along their own lines, everybody else tribes up too. It starts to look like a prison where you might not have been a white supremacist going in, but you have to become one if you want to survive, right? Because everybody else is...
You're making my point, though. Like, if you go to prison and you're a white guy and you are a white guy, then you would want to be...
But what I'm saying is don't start that environment that's in the prison in the first place. Don't have an environment that's divided along those lines and where everybody's forced to tribe up.
What if people already believe that? Then don't you have to participate
in it? And you want to do the best you can to suppress that. How do you do that? You do that by avoiding any sense of group distinction in your society. You don't put racial or ethnic categories on government forms, for example, that tell people that they belong to this group or that group. And by the way, these groups, they are very susceptible to categories that are constructed by government. You know, categories that didn't exist before. People will identify as Asian now. What kind of sense does that make? You know, Asian includes people who live in Turkey and people who live in the Philippines. They got nothing in common. Yet you've actually created a group there with a government policy. So that's number one, is you don't create an environment where that makes sense. You don't foster those divisions. And on the contrary, you suppress them. You encourage people to think of themselves as Americans and not as a member of this group or that group.
A supraordinate identity.
Yes, exactly. The super tribe.
Okay, so I've just been playing devil's advocate about some claims that I frequently hear, again, that I disagree with, and you touch upon those in your book.
Very effectively, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So I want to talk to you specifically. You've gone around the world. You've looked at the melting pot, you've looked at multiculturalism. What have you learned that we can and should implement in the society at a macro level? And are there any like pieces of counsel that you could give individuals?
Yeah, you know, I've gotten this question a bit, and the best answer I can give is you don't need to do anything specific. You just gotta stop doing the wrong stuff. You gotta stop encouraging distinctions and divisions among people. You know, societies in history and around the world, they always grow together. Groups within a society, you know, you could name any country in this world practically, barring Iceland, and I can tell you how that society is different groups that came together and came to see themselves as a whole. You know, take Italy, for example. People say, oh yeah, Italy, they're Italians. Well, you know, 150 years ago, there weren't Italians. There were Piedmontese and Friulians and Lombardies and Sicilians.
What about Japan? They've only been Japanese people.
Koreans in Japan are, you know, 15, 20%. You have the Ainu. You have the Barakamen. You never hear about the Barakamen anymore. So different groups came together. What is England? Angles, Picts, Utes. lots of different groups. And so... if you don't do anything to encourage those group distinctions, people will grow together. So that's, you know, object number one is not to do the bad stuff.
Okay. So one of the things that I keep hearing about is global citizenry. You think the world would be a better place if we were all global citizens? And is that the biggest superordinate group, global citizens?
I think it's hard to cultivate an effective identity that's that broad spanning. I don't think it's ever been done. And I think even a country of 300 million in itself is actually fairly challenging to have that large a group. And, you know, some of the research I'm doing right now after this book is into how it is that people above, say, the Dunbar number actually get along with each other. You know,
what's the Dunbar number?
160, I think, is kind of roughly the number we're talking about, which is the number of people that you kind of recognize and you know in your social circle, and can therefore sort of develop a cooperative relationship with. You know, it's a miracle that larger societies actually manage to exist.
If you were advising, and it looks, I don't know this obviously at the time of this recording, if you were advising the next president or the current president, what he can do in terms of a multicultural domestic policy, what would your advice be?
The first thing I would do is eliminate all the affirmative action type programs. And many of them still exist. I just looked at the GSA website, I think it was yesterday, day before, and they still have programs for, you know, women-owned businesses and so on. And, you know, their other government contracting still has programs that they force the subcontractors to have affirmative action programs. You got to get rid of all that stuff.
So I'm not playing devil's advocate now, I'm just being really serious. What if you got rid of all that stuff and the disparities increased, which I expect that they would?
I think what was found, for example, in California after I think Prop 209, if I got the number correct, Ward Connerly, you know, the original resolution that one of the things, you know, obviously the enrollment in the higher tier UC schools, Berkeley, that dropped, and you know, the number of Asian went up, but the success rate of blacks went up too.
So what do you mean?
The ones who actually, you know, graduated in 4 years. So it was addressing that mismatch problem, right? So that helped a lot. And you know, so I wanted to get to another point though that's even more important than this. If you want affirmative action to end in the United States, you have to take aim at legacy preferences first.
100%. I could not pop. I've been freaking screaming about that from the rooftops for over a decade.
Yeah. So what this is about, and you know, before I opposed affirmative action,
could not possibly agree more.
I opposed legacy preferences because
100%.
You know, affirmative action is at most schools 5-10%. Legacy preferences, it's like 30%.
Okay. So here's what's crazy to me. The schools that have legacy preferences, I don't think they have legacy preferences in the UK, or certainly not anywhere near the degree that we do. What are legacy preferences?
So I want to draw a broader category here because it's important. So legacy preferences, first of all, we're talking about benefiting the children of alumni.
Correct.
But I kind of group that together with another set. There's what we call Dean's List, right, which is major contributors, people, you know, it's like Brooke Shields goes to Princeton. How does that happen? So then there's yet another category that most people don't even talk about, and that's the athletic recruits.
Right.
Right. The stereotype we all have of the athletic recruits is, you know, some poor inner city black kid gets accepted on a basketball or football scholarship. Mm-mm. That's not it. When you get to Harvard, you go to any of the Ivy League schools, and you add up all the sports, the rowing, the golf, the sailing, the number of white kids vastly outstrips the number of black kids. And these kids are mostly highly privileged, right?
I just want to go back to the legacy. What is the problem with legacy admissions?
The problem is that these kids are being accepted based on their heritage. And, you know, it's a predominantly white group, right, and for the Ivy League schools.
So it's non-meritocratic.
It's non-meritocratic.
Okay.
And, you know, how non-meritocratic is it? We have the numbers.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that a problem? Because the very same people who are screaming about land acknowledgments, et cetera, also have legacy admissions.
Yes.
So there's a kind of deep-seated hypocrisy going on, like an unbelievable hypocrisy.
Yes, absolutely.
But that would only be a problem if you valued Aristotle's laws of non-contradiction and you thought hypocrisy was a problem. So, yeah. You know, that's bothered me for quite a while. Okay, so we got the legacy admissions. Explain something to me. I've asked over 100 people this. I've not had a single response that I've been like, oh, maybe, or oh, that's interesting. Explain this to me, if you're comfortable explaining it to me. So if you look at the top 10% of applicants to Harvard, and you just looked at SAT scores and grades, over 50% of those students would be cold climate Asians. I have asked so many people this, and I have not gotten a response, any reasonable response. What is the problem with that?
There is no problem.
Well, I don't think there's a problem with it either.
I don't
what
have
would
a problem.
The, what would, how could you steel man that? Like, what do you, like, what would somebody say who believed that that would be a problem?
The argument I get is that regardless of merit, it's helpful for society for people to mix with people who don't look like them, right? So it's good for you to interact and study alongside other people. So Singapore, which for example, you know, is really highly meritocratic in their housing, they actually do limit. They limit the percentage of this or that group that can be any given building because they want people of different types to live together. And, you know, that's the best argument I've heard for it is it's integration.
What, you need more people to integrate rather than 50% of the people to be Asians?
Right. Yeah, well, rather than having, you know, people grow up entirely, you know, in a balkanized fashion where they only encounter people who look and have the same background as them.
Okay, so final question. How can we encourage integration? Cultural assimilation, social?
You know, I think one of the best ways we've seen it done in this country is in the military, right? You look at a list of the top generals in the United States over the last few decades. You've got names like Jewel Wan, who is Lebanese, Shinseki, Shekharjian, we have Georgian, Armenian, Japanese, you name it. Our list of generals is like a Benetton commercial. There's so many different groups represented. Most of those guys, including you know, like Colin Powell, they're first or second generation immigrants. So the military has been wonderfully successful at bringing different groups together. My own father, I mean, he came from Germany, and he joined the U.S. Army within a year of arriving here, and became a loyal American within 2 years, right? He became an American citizen.
So what does the Army do? What does the Army use that we can help people integrate? So like, what value?
Yeah, so what they do is they bring people of all different backgrounds together, and they assign them to work on a common purpose. So
there's a series of really interesting commercials about that. There are beer commercials where they have people who, like someone who doesn't like trans people and a trans person working to build something together. Fascinating.
Exactly. So one of the things I'm actually looking at promoting in my next book is this idea of a national service program. Like what
just
they had in Germany and in France for many years. So you could either go into the military, that's one route. The other route is you go into this national service program, and instead of just handing out, you know, $500 billion for student loans like Biden, you know, wants to forgive right now, we say you do 2 years in national service, and then you get your college loans or your grant to start a business and all this other stuff that just normally gets handed out now for free, we say, be in a service program first. And guess what? You're going to be working with immigrants from all over the world, with black people, brown people, people who don't look like you. And you're all going to, you're going to work on this project together. And you'd be amazed at how quickly that can bring people together.
Fantastic.
One of the things they did in Rwanda that worked really well is they have these national work days, Umuganda,
call it. I remember that, yeah.
And so they've got Hutus and Tutsis and all these different groups working together, and it has worked really well. They did this in Yugoslavia, too, before they took the wrong path.
Jens, out of the melting pot into the fire, where can people find your book and where can people find you?
So it's sold by Encounter Books. It's also available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. All the online booksellers have it. You can order it from your local bookstore as well. So I have a Substack as well that you can go to. I just started. Please don't pay for a subscription because I don't want to deal with it. So just get it for free. Twitter as well. So.
Okay. What's your Twitter handle?
It's just Jens Heike. It's my
excellent
first name with no spaces.
Well, thank you for the conversation. I appreciate it. And I really enjoy the primary message you have of common humanity. And I think that's what we need.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for watching. Everything we do is under the umbrella of the National Progress Alliance, nationalprogressalliance.org. It's a nonprofit, independent 501c3. Your generous donations keep us going and keep fueling content like this. So please help us out, make a donation. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.